Wedding plans and property empire. Wedding plans and property empire. With our wedding officially on the cards, Diane had her heart set on a full-blown white church wedding, complete with classic Rolls-Royce transport to both the church and the reception venue. While I initially questioned the cost and gently suggested a quieter registry office ceremony with just close family, Diane made it clear, if she was going to do this, she was going to do it properly. After all, she said she only planned on getting married once, and she wanted the day to be shared with all her family and friends, no matter how distant. I couldn't argue with that. It had taken a lot for Diane to finally say yes and commit, and the least I could do was make sure she had the day of her dreams. So I agreed, happily. The day was set for the 9th July 2004. Together with her two sisters and her mother, Diane dove into planning every last detail. They handled it all, groom and best man suits for our sons, Gary, her brother-in-law, bridesmaid dresses for Caitlin, Lucy, her niece, and more. Everyone was invited to the ceremony at St. Margaret's Lee, a grand old church built in the early Victorian era between 1839 and 1841. It was beautiful in its simplicity. The reception was to be held at the Bromley Court Hotel. The only wrinkle was figuring out who to invite to the sit-down meal and who to welcome later in the evening for drinks and canapés. There was a lot to plan, and I was more than happy to let Diane and her sisters take the reins on that. My job, as I saw it, was to figure out how to fund the whole thing. And in true Ace and Jameel style, if I was going to raise money by borrowing against the equity of my house on Old Road, I wasn't just going to stop at the wedding. I saw it as an opportunity. That's when one of my infamous brainwaves hit. Why not use the extra funds to invest in property? I approached Fred with the idea of going into business together. At the time, buy-to-let was booming. Mortgages were relatively easy to get with just a 10% deposit. If we could buy properties at a reduced price, fix them up, rent them out, and remortgage once their value rose, we could build a solid portfolio. Any repairs or renovations, we'd pay Fred for his skills, and we'd split the profits. Fred was on board, so I started looking for our first project, and soon found one in Blackheath, 30 Sun Lane. It was a small, one-bedroom, detached property with a front courtyard, tucked away down an alley. The living room had some damp, but with a bit of work and some clever reconfiguration, we saw potential to convert it into a two-bedroom, boosting its rental value. I managed to negotiate the purchase at £143,500, and in June 2003, we bought the property. I needed about £15,000 for the deposit. I calculated that if I borrowed an additional £60,000 against my home, it would cover the deposit, building work, our wedding, and even a honeymoon, an all-inclusive escape to a sandals resort in the Bahamas. The funding came through smoothly, and we pressed ahead. But as luck would have it, the rental market took a dip just as we finished the renovations. Finding a reliable tenant became a challenge, and the interest-only mortgage quickly began to eat into our funds. Eventually, Fred and I agreed to sell. In May 2004, we sold the house for £199,000, netting us a profit of around £55,500 before expenses. After paying Fred his share, I walked away with roughly £40,000, including the deposit I had initially invested. Fred decided the stress and financial risk wasn't for him, and he bowed out of the property game. I, on the other hand, was hooked. I'd gotten a taste for it, and I was already scanning the market for my next opportunity. I was determined to continue with the buy-to-let venture. The excitement of the first property deal had lit a fire in me, and I started scanning upcoming property auctions for the next opportunity. That's when I came across two flats listed for sale in the Plaza building, Lehigh Road, Lewisham. Both were in the same block, two-bedroom units, and in pretty decent condition. They were owned by a firm of accountants based in the same courtyard, who were now offloading them. On the day of the auction, I set off with a clear intention. I'd bid on one flat, if the price was right. In my head, I had a rough upper limit of £140,000, which I felt was the maximum they were worth. When the first flat came up, I managed to secure it for £123,000. I was thrilled. It felt like a smart buy, and the numbers made sense. But then something unexpected happened. The second flat, Lot B, came up immediately after, and without much hesitation, I bid on that one too, and won it, again for £123,000. I couldn't believe my luck. Two flats in the same block, both below my estimated value. It felt like everything had fallen into place perfectly. I even thought of it as a bit of a romantic gesture. One flat for me, and one as a surprise wedding present for Diane. But when I got home and told her the news, the reaction wasn't quite what I had hoped for. Diane wasn't impressed. I'd told her I was only going to buy one, and she felt I'd gone against our agreement. She was upset that I had ignored her advice, and I could see that trust had been dented, even if my intentions were good. Still, I reassured her, give it a couple of months, get tenants in, and once the flats were rented, we could remortgage and pull out our deposits. The valuations were higher than what I paid, so in theory, it would all balance out. Renting them out turned out to be straightforward. We used an estate agent called Gower in Greenwich. My flat was quickly let to a Chinese student who paid his £750 monthly rent and deposit in cash. Diane's flat went to an African couple expecting their first baby. They moved in just before the birth and started paying their rent reliably from day one. Not long after, just before the wedding, Diane's mum pulled me aside. She didn't seem thrilled about the flat. She said it wasn't good for Diane to have an asset in her name. It could create tax issues. I told her I'd speak to my solicitor, Jerry McBride at Grantsaw in Greenwich, to get some clarity. Jerry later sent me an email outlining the situation. If Diane was to benefit from owning the flat and receiving rental income, she would also have to take on any associated tax liabilities. She couldn't just enjoy the property's appreciation without declaring the income or dealing with the legal responsibilities. If I was the one taking on the burden, then legally and financially, I should also be the one benefiting. He suggested I think carefully about whether gifting her the flat was the right move, especially since Diane didn't want to involve HMRC. I decided to hold off on making any changes until Diane and I had time to sit down and talk it through properly. I printed the email, filed it under the flat documents, and tucked it away safely in our study at the old roadhouse, knowing the conversation would have to happen, just not right now. With the wedding fast approaching, the stag and hen do's were on the horizon. Diane had her plans, and my best man Fred had gone all out, organizing a 3-day, 2-night lads trip to Fuengirola in Spain. The lineup was solid: Martin, my sons Ben and Remy, my dad, my brothers Erman and Alkin, my brother-in-law Sammy and his son Temel, Gary, Diane's brother-in-law Don, the park ranger, Paul Warlock, my old school mate, Kevin Tweedy, Derek, Alan Petter's brother-in-law. Alan himself couldn't make it. He was just recovering from a hip operation. Once we touched down and checked into our hotel, we wasted no time. First night, dinner, drinks, laughs, and planning the madness ahead. After the meal, we headed out toward the marina, spirits flying high, when Erman, always the joker, threw out a challenge. If anyone jumps into that rowing boat over there, I'll give him 20 quid. Before the sentence had even finished, Kevin Tweedy took off, sprinted toward the edge, and launched himself straight into the boat. He landed it like a pro. The boat rocked wildly, but he stayed upright. We erupted with cheers and laughter. Then came the realization. It was easy getting in, but the boat was around 10 feet from the wall and down a good 5-foot drop. Now Kevin had to pull on the chain and somehow drag the boat close enough to get out. We weren't much help. We were too busy laughing. Erman joked, "Leave him in there. That way I'll keep the 20 quid. Eventually, we hauled Kevin back up, completely dry but definitely puffing for breath. Back on land, someone suggested we all chip in and nominate a banker for the night. Kevin, still riding his victory, offered to do the honors. We handed him the cash and carried on to the next bar. Only, when we got inside, Kevin was gone. Just vanished. We looked around, had a laugh, chose someone else, and carried on drinking. The Euros were on, but England were already knocked out. None of us were too fussed. Greece went on to win that year, but we had other priorities. Later in the night, Martin and my dad decided to call it a night and headed back to the hotel. The rest of us were still fired up and trying to find a club, but we hit a snag. Ben, Remy, and Temel were underage, and most places were turning us away. That's when we found Heaven, a lively bar that let us all in without a second glance. The place was buzzing, The music was loud, and the drinks were flowing. We were well into the night before it dawned on us. Heaven was a gay club. Not that it mattered. We were all having a great time, dancing, laughing, embracing the chaos. Honestly, what is it with me and gay venues? Eventually, we stumbled out in the early hours, still laughing. Someone suggested a walk along the beach. Then another genius piped up, "Skinny dip?" Fueled by booze and zero hesitation, we stripped off and ran into the sea like lunatics. Cold, freezing, hilarious, absolutely. But halfway through the splashing and shouting, Paul and I realized everyone else had legged it, with my clothes. Paul's were left on the sand. Mine, gone. He handed me the hotel keycard to cover myself. The walk back, under the rising sun, was long and sobering. When we reached the hotel, the rest of the lads were already there, cracking up in the lobby. I tried to walk in, but the security guard blocked me. "I'm a guest," I said, flashing the keycard, half covered and freezing. As if it couldn't get worse, the front doors slid open and enrolled a full coachload of SAGA holidaymakers, their suitcase wheels rattling across the tiles. I caught the shocked expressions, a few chuckles, and the roaring laughter of my mates echoing through the lobby. A stag night to remember, without question. When we touched down at Gatwick after the stag weekend, Fred suggested we all have one last drink to round things off. I thought nothing of it at the time. Just a final toast to a weekend of laughs and chaos, one we'd be talking about for years. What I didn't know was that it wasn't about the drink at all. Diane had been in touch with him. While I was away, she'd been orchestrating a surprise, one of her grand gestures, the kind that always left me both speechless and smitten. She had secretly commissioned a full makeover of our front garden, bringing in Charles Hutton, a local horticulturist and fellow parent at the kids' primary school. He and his wife were part of our close-knit little community, and they'd been working flat out for the last 72 hours. But they needed just a little more time before the big reveal, and Fred was buying it for them. As the cab rounded the corner into Old Road, I caught sight of it. A brand new trellis, delicate and elegant, framing the space. There was a small wrought iron bistro table with matching chairs, sitting on fresh decking. A silver sphere fountain bubbled gently, catching the light as water trickled over it. It was serene, stylish, like something from a magazine. As we pulled up, I noticed the details. Tastefully planted flower beds, a bench made from solid railway sleepers, everything perfectly placed to create an atmosphere of calm and care. And there they were, Diane, Caitlin, Josh, Charles, and his team, all standing in the garden with glasses of champagne, grinning from ear to ear. I was stunned. That was Diane, thoughtful, imaginative, full of surprises. She didn't just decorate gardens, she turned them into little sanctuaries. She'd poured so much of herself into it, and I could see it in every detail. But she wasn't finished yet. She added one last twist, a game, a challenge just for us, to be revealed during the wedding reception at the Bromley Court Hotel. The rules were simple. We each had to do something we had never done before, something meaningful or daring, something on our personal list we'd always wanted to try. And we had to prove it. Photos, a story, anything that made it real. Budget, £100. The winner would be whoever pulled off the most memorable experience for the least amount of money. Classic Diane, clever, cheeky, and full of heart. In the days leading up to the wedding, I noticed she seemed a little withdrawn. I chalked it up to nerves, stress, the whirlwind of preparations. I should have asked more, but I didn't. I just kept moving with the current. Then, suddenly, it was here. The wedding day. Our suits were on, tails and all. Diane was at her mum's, getting ready with the bridesmaids, her hair being styled for the big moment. Fred, my best man, turned up right on time, and together with Ben, Remy, and little Josh, we made our way to the church. Seeing both my mum and dad there was a moment I'll never forget. They hadn't been at my first wedding, but this time they were there, seated in the pews of a sacred space, ready to witness something they truly believed in. That meant the world to me. St. Margaret's was packed to the rafters. Even friends who hadn't been invited to the reception turned up, just to be part of the moment. The atmosphere buzzed with anticipation, full of warmth, of hope, of love. And then, right on cue, the vintage Rolls-Royce pulled up outside. Diane had arrived. Martin leaned over to me and whispered with a grin, I've got the engine running, if you fancy a quick getaway. I laughed quietly at the thought, but shook my head. Not this time. Diane's brother-in-law, Gary, had the honor of walking her down the aisle. She looked breathtaking, holding a delicate bouquet of flowers in her hands. Just a step behind her, moving with a gentle, unhurried grace, came Caitlin and Lucy, the bridesmaids, each cradling a smaller bouquet of perfectly arranged blooms. Close on their heels were Josh, Theo, and little Daniel, the page boys, trailing along with solemn determination, their small footsteps echoing the weight of the moment. When Diane reached my side, I leaned in close and whispered, "You look absolutely stunning. I love you." She smiled softly, but I noticed her eyes were red, and it was clear she'd been crying. I asked if she was okay. She nodded, gave my hand a reassuring squeeze, and smiled again. That was enough for me. The ceremony could begin. Justin, the new vicar, officiated with warmth and care. She made the whole moment feel personal and sincere. Then came a surprise. Sean, Jenny's son and Diane's nephew, played a violin piece that was absolutely mesmerizing. I had no idea he even played, let alone that he could play so beautifully. The notes filled the space with emotion, and it was truly unforgettable. For the register signing, both Diane's mom, Opal, and my mom, Zara, stepped up to witness the moment. Another emotional milestone for me, especially having my mom there after everything we'd been through. After the ceremony and a blur of photos, we made our way to the Bromley Court Hotel. The reception was beautiful. Diane and her sisters had clearly gone to great lengths. No detail had been missed. Every table had personalized name tags, and there was even a decorative painter's trellis with a seating plan delicately arranged for our guests. It all felt like a dream brought to life. The meal was incredible, the speeches unforgettable. Gary spoke with heartfelt charm, but Fred, my best man, stole the show with a wicked surprise. He'd somehow developed photos from my naked beach walk during the stag trip and sneakily placed them in envelopes on every table. As he told the story and cued the moment, our guests roared with laughter, me included, even if I was a bit red in the face. What happened to "what goes on in Spain stays in Spain"? Then came the part Diane had been waiting for, our wedding challenge. Diane stood up and announced to our guests that we had set a task for each other, something we'd never done before, with proof required and a strict 100-pound budget. Whoever pulled off the most meaningful or entertaining experience for the least amount of money would be crowned the winner. I went first. Growing up in Swanley, we were always out and about, playing football, riding bikes, climbing trees in Farningham Woods. During the construction of the M25, we'd sneak onto the unopened motorway to mess around on the massive mounds of sand and soil. One day, I missed an epic moment when one of the lads managed to start up a construction vehicle, a JCB, and actually drove it down the motorway path. I was gutted. After that, we planned to go back and race the dumpers, but security showed up and we legged it. So for the challenge, I decided it was finally time. I went to Diggerland, just off the A2 near Rochester, basically paradise for big kids like me. There, I got to operate a real JCB. Not only did I get a certificate as proof, I even brought along a little Tonka-style replica to show off the beast I'd driven. Total cost? Less than 50 pounds. I was feeling pretty confident. Then it was Diane's turn. She stood up and told everyone about how Philip, her ex, who owned a powerful motorbike. He used to ride up from Eastbourne to pick up Theo, and back then, Diane had always wondered what it would be like to ride one herself. So for her challenge, she signed up for a motorcycle training session through the local police-run initiative. After a bit of classroom theory, she was introduced to a 250cc motorbike, which she described as a beast, heavy and intimidating. But after a full-on day of learning the gears, handling the bike, and pushing through the nerves, she passed with flying colors. And here's the kicker. When she applied, she told the instructors she was doing it as part of a wedding challenge with her soon-to-be husband. They loved the idea so much, they waived the fee completely. So not only had she done something bold, empowering, and out of her comfort zone, she did it for free. She won. And honestly, I didn't mind losing one bit. The day gently unfolded into a joyful celebration, a perfect blend of old and new. I found myself chatting with friends I'd known for years and meeting family and friends of Diane's that even she hadn't seen in a long time. It was a true coming together of lives, histories, and stories. Of course, no wedding is without its moments. My Uncle Asen, ever the interrogator, took it upon himself to ask Diane, right there at the reception, whether her intentions were genuine, if she truly loved me and wasn't marrying for any other reason. My dad had overheard and intervened, putting Uncle Asen in his place and defending Diane with calm authority. It meant a lot to her and to me when Diane told me. Later in the evening, my brother and his partner had a heated exchange, which ended with them leaving early. I was told, via the grapevine, that it had something to do with our wedding triggering old tensions. They'd been together for years, without ever talking marriage, and apparently seeing me remarry brought some buried frustrations to the surface. Whether true or not, it wouldn't be the first time a family event stirred up unexpected drama. As they say, it's not a proper bit of ado without a few fireworks. That night, a number of our guests stayed at the hotel, and Diane and I retired to the honeymoon suite. I wasn't prepared for the sight that greeted us. Our room was filled with beautifully wrapped gifts and a mountain of cards from well-wishers. Diane and her sisters had created a wedding list at John Lewis, and clearly our guests had taken note. It was a humbling moment. But the night wasn't quite over. Now alone, Diane brought up something that had been troubling her for weeks. She'd come across a letter from Jerry McBride, my solicitor, who had advised that I shouldn't transfer one of the flats to Diane due to potential tax complications. It had clearly bothered her. I explained that while Jerry had made the suggestion, I'd never acted on it. The flat was still in her name, and the rental income was going straight into her account. I'd planned to talk to her about it properly, to explain everything and make sure she felt secure. In fact, I'd already instructed the brokers to begin the remortgaging process so we could retrieve the deposits we'd put down at auction, and since the ground floor flat was in her name, the funds would go directly to her. But she wasn't reassured. She said her sister Joanna and her mum believed I couldn't be trusted, that I was only after the money. That hit hard. I told her I didn't understand the accusation. The money I'd used to kickstart the property ventures came from the equity in the house I owned with Sally, and in return, I'd gifted her a flat worth around £140,000. She countered with everything she'd contributed, money towards the failed film business, investments into the cafe and manor house gardens, and funds for home renovations. I acknowledged that, but reminded her that most of the renovation spending had been to make Theo and Caitlin feel settled, comfortable, and at home. And the front garden makeover she'd done, well, that had benefited her too. Still, the energy shifted. Arguing about money has a way of sucking the warmth out of a moment, especially when love is meant to be the focus. That night didn't go how I imagined. The day had been electric, full of love and joy, but the night was quieter, clouded by doubt. I told her, truthfully, that what I had was hers, and I hoped what she had was mine. Maybe that wasn't the perfect answer, but I wanted her to know my heart was in the right place. I wasn't after anything. The next morning, we packed our bags and made our way to Heathrow, flying with British Airways. Diane's mum had the kids, and though we didn't speak much about the night before, I hoped the worst was behind us, that she'd believe in me, in us. We settled into our economy seats, commenting on the surprisingly decent legroom, when a stewardess approached and asked us to gather our things and follow her. Slightly confused but intrigued, we did. She led us to luxury class. Fully reclining seats, smoked salmon, champagne, the works. We were stunned. It turned out my cousin Jasmine, Uncle Ison's daughter, worked for British Airways and had arranged the upgrade as a surprise wedding gift. A 10-hour flight to the Bahamas had never looked so good. What a touch. We landed at Nassau Airport and were warmly greeted by the Sandals Resort rep, who whisked us away to our luxury all-inclusive retreat. The place was incredible, 5 different restaurants, stunning pools, and a private beach that looked like something straight out of a postcard. It felt like paradise, and for the most part, things between us were good. We were talking, laughing, enjoying the moment, but I could still sense a faint undercurrent of tension. I didn't want to bring it up, though. This was our honeymoon, and I feared that asking might reopen wounds we hadn't quite let heal. Instead, we threw ourselves into the experiences. We swam with dolphins, an unforgettable moment. We even took a ride in a personal underwater submersible, something that immediately reminded me of my old scuba diving days. Diane seemed to love it, just as she did the paragliding we tried one breezy afternoon. Watching her soar above the turquoise sea, carefree and smiling, I started to believe we'd turned a corner. Later, floating together in the warm Caribbean waters, I tried to lean into a more intimate moment, hoping the peace of the ocean might soften the space between us. But she pulled away gently, whispering with a smile, "Not in the sea." A playful moment on the surface, but one that left me wondering what was still lingering beneath. Later that night, I brought it up. I asked Diane, half-teasing, half-curious, if she'd ever made out in the ocean before. I was expecting a playful no. But instead, she said yes. A long time ago, on a holiday in Torquay with a boyfriend. That threw me a little. I asked who it was, and she told me. I knew him. I'd met him. Bought him drinks and food when he was round at Old Road. She'd never mentioned they'd been together. I didn't want to care, but I did. It stung. This was supposed to be our honeymoon, a chance to make memories. And yet, in the very moment that could have been intimate and romantic, she brushed me off. When she hadn't said no to an ex she still saw now and then, even as friends with his wife and kids, she insisted it wasn't my business, that it didn't matter. That's why she never mentioned it. But to me, it did matter. And sadly, it ended in another argument. The atmosphere between us became strained. Awkward silences, forced smiles, and the kind of polite conversations you might have with a distant relative, not your new spouse. We passed the time reading our books and sticking close to the resort. One afternoon, a few local women came to the hotel offering hair braiding. Diane volunteered. The result? She looked incredible. Something about the look reminded me of Bo Derek in 10. Sexy, confident, effortless. If it was meant to annoy me, it had the opposite effect. Trying to lighten the mood, I suggested we leave the resort and explore the island a bit. We headed to Bay Street in Nassau, wandering past high-end shops, Cartier, Rolex, and the like, before ending up at the Nassau Straw Market, a bustling open-air space filled with handcrafted goods and souvenirs. But Diane wasn't having it. She said she felt uncomfortable and unsafe. She wanted to go back. I was frustrated. This was the Bahamas. We'd flown 10 hours to get here, and she wanted to stay tucked away behind the resort gates. I snapped, "We could have gone to the Med and saved a fortune. It wouldn't matter to you if we were in the Bahamas or Butlins in Bognor." Yep, another argument, just what we needed. After that, we barely spoke. I think we were both quietly counting down the days until it was time to go home. When departure day finally came, just our luck, our flight was canceled. The airline put all passengers up in another hotel overnight. Unfortunately, it was grim, filthy, cockroach-infested, and not the kind of last memory we were hoping for. Diane, who had a genuine phobia of creepy crawlies, couldn't sleep a wink, convinced one would crawl into her mouth while she slept. The flight home the next day was long. We were back in our original economy seats, a far cry from the champagne and smoked salmon upgrade we had on the way out. We barely said a word the whole way back. Ironic, really. Two newlyweds sitting in silence. When we got home, we didn't tell anyone the full story. Instead, we showed the kids the video footage of us in the mini-submarines, gliding under the water like explorers. We even shared a chilling detail we'd only found out later, thanks to a neighboring tour boat. Their guests had been swimming with white sharks just offshore, and their boat had been in the same waters as ours, not far in the distance. After showing the kids the video from our honeymoon, I was hit with a wave of guilt. The last few months had been all about Diane and me, wedding planning, property deals, the honeymoon, while the kids patiently were in the background. They deserved their own moment, their own joy. I still had some money left in my account, and with the remortgage funds expected soon, I decided to do something special for everyone. I planned a family trip to Rhodes, 15 of us in total. Gary and his family of four came along, as did Joanna and her son Daniel, and Opal, Diane's mom. We booked into an all-inclusive resort to keep things simple and cost-effective. The whole trip set me back around £8,000. We even brought Caitlin's friend Joe, who worked part-time with us at the cafe in Manor House Gardens. She blended in perfectly. The week was full of energy and chaos, with some standout moments. One of the highlights was scuba diving, me, Gary, and the kids. My boys loved it. Ben, Remy, and Josh were strong swimmers, thanks to their regular sessions with Saxon Swimming Club at Ladywell Baths. The others were a bit more hesitant, but they gave it a go. I'll never forget Opal's one-time attempt at taking the boys swimming while we were on our honeymoon. She swore never again. The boys, while deeply bonded, could be rowdy and argumentative, especially in public. Opal wasn't used to that kind of noise and found the whole experience mortifying. Later in the week, we took the older kids, Ben, Remy, Caitlin, Joe, and Gary, clubbing in Falaraki. Somehow we ended up in a gay bar. Again. It reminded me of Spain. Unintentional, but hilarious. And we all had a blast. We also explored the island's quieter side, visiting the postcard-worthy village of Rhodes. Riding mules up the steep, narrow streets was touristy, sure, but undeniably charming. Diane, however, stayed at the hotel with her sisters and mum. She didn't join any of the outings. We still shared breakfast and dinner and took in the evening entertainment at the resort, but the tension between us was thick. My attempt at patching things up with generosity clearly wasn't enough. In fact, it felt like things were already falling apart. And once we got back home, they did. Diane didn't even come to collect her things. Her mother and sisters arrived at the house and, following Diane's instructions, cleared everything out. Her belongings, her plants, the kids. She was completely absent. It was a clean, cold break. I was devastated. How do you go from a wedding, words of love, promises made, to walking away in just a few weeks? For her, it came down to trust. The honeymoon hadn't helped. She didn't believe me when I said the flat was hers without conditions. She thought I had an agenda. We returned to separate lives, her in her house with the kids, me and mine with mine. I continued running the cafe, but the spark was gone. The flats were remortgaged. She got back the deposit I had paid on them, and I received my share from my own property. The plan was always to reinvest together, build a portfolio, but that dream dissolved. Diane had shut down all communication. I still had feelings for her, but they weren't reciprocated. I started thinking about Philippa again, how close we'd been before I ended things for Diane. Had I made the wrong choice? I'd hurt Philippa badly when I told her I didn't love her. But now, I was the one left hurting. A few weeks later, I heard Diane was using the money to renovate her floors. She'd hired Adrian, the estranged husband of one of her friends, someone I never got on with. He was living temporarily with Opal. I started noticing his car parked outside Diane's house, too often for it to be coincidence. It started to gnaw at me. Running had always been part of my fitness routine, especially to keep up with the punishing games of squash I sometimes played with professional boxers. After the split, I adjusted my usual route, just enough to pass by her street. And every time I did, his car was there, like clockwork. I became obsessed. I wasn't focusing on work or the kids. I was consumed by the idea that Diane was seeing him. One night, I saw the car again. I tried to run off the rage, but by the time I got home, I was fuming. I got in my car and drove straight to her house. I banged on the door. Nothing. The silence made it worse. I lost it, kicked the door open, and stormed in. No one was downstairs. I charged upstairs, expecting to find Adrian. Instead, I found Diane with Theo beside her in bed. Caitlin stood nearby, shocked. Adrian wasn't there. I was wrong, but I was shaking with anger and heartbreak. I pulled off my wedding ring and threw it at Diane, telling her it was over, as if it hadn't already ended. I drove home in pieces. The boys were upstairs. Josh was already asleep. I felt ashamed. I called the police to report what I had done. Before I could even finish the call, a van pulled up. Diane had already called them. The officers were kind. I let them in, explained everything. I asked them to wait while I called someone to stay with the boys. They agreed. Since I'd called them too, they understood I wasn't a threat. No handcuffs. They just did the usual, fingerprints, a swab, and took me in for the night. I was released with a warning to stay away from Diane. I agreed. Back home, Fred, Martin, Marco, David, and Andy came over. We played music, drank, tried to lighten the mood. My freedom felt bitter, but they did their best to lift me. Meanwhile, a bizarre subplot unfolded. Remy, Ben, and Luke had recently discovered an old .22 air rifle in the loft, one that used to belong to my brother. They'd been sneaking up there, shooting at signs and pigeons through the Valux windows. When the police showed up, they were convinced it was about the gun. They were relieved it wasn't. But they were also stunned. It was me the police had come for. The days slipped into weeks, and true to my word, I didn't contact Diane again. Although I continued sending cash over every week, I knew Diane didn't have much income to fall back on. She received some rent from her flat on Lehigh Road, but beyond that, she was relying heavily on her savings. By that autumn, Caitlin was attending St. Dunstan's College, a private school in Catford, and Theo had just started at Riverstone School, another private institution. That same autumn, our flat suffered a major setback. A demolition crew, working with a JCB on the site next door, accidentally struck our building with enough force to bring down bricks and mortar, even damaging the CEO's Mercedes parked on the accountant's forecourt. The impact caused a deep crack to run up the chimney breast, stretching from Diane's ground floor flat all the way to mine on the first floor. Little had recently purchased the neighboring plot, the infamous Fry's Ford car sales garage, and had begun demolition work to clear the site for a new store and residential flats. Diane's tenants, a Nigerian couple with a baby, quickly moved out, feeling unsafe. I later discovered they had left without giving notice and had taken many of Diane's white goods with them. I was more fortunate. My tenant, a quiet Chinese gentleman, seemed unfazed by the upheaval and continued to pay his rent promptly in cash. I tried to concentrate on my business and into raising my sons, keeping as busy as I could. Marco would often chastise me for continuing to send Diane money, reminding me that she had walked away from the marriage and ended up with a second property, one where the deposit had been funded through money borrowed against the equity in my own house. On top of that, she had received the deposit back in cash when we remortgaged the flats. I pointed out that Diane had also contributed significantly to the renovations of our home, including the complete makeover of the front garden. He accepted that I felt a sense of obligation toward her, but his main concern was that I should prioritize taking care of my sons before handing over any more cash. I agreed with him and assured him that I was doing exactly that. Still in my heart, I continued to see Diane as my wife, and therefore my responsibility. Marco, Martin, and Fred became regular visitors to the cafe, often dropping by to check up on me and lift my spirits with their jokes and stories. It was always good to see them. Irene and Jeff, both in their 80s, were daily fixtures too. I had made a quiet promise to myself. I wouldn't charge many of our elderly visitors for their tea or coffee. It was a small gesture of respect for a generation that had worked hard and paid their dues to society. I knew that for some of them, just getting out of the house was a triumph in itself. And besides, the cafe was doing well enough with our regular business. We could afford a little kindness. Irene's story stayed with me. She had lost her husband, a former POW who had survived brutal conditions in a Japanese camp during the Second World War. Even after the war ended, he struggled with the trauma, finding it impossible to forgive when Western countries resumed trade with Japan. Eventually, it became too much for him, and he took his own life. Irene had one daughter, but heartbreak struck again when her daughter died of breast cancer in her 30s. Jeff, a lifelong family friend who had never married, became Irene's companion. After her daughter's death, what started as frequent visits turned into a permanent move. Jeff sold his house and moved in to be there for her. Every afternoon, Irene would walk to the park, while Jeff, undergoing prostate cancer treatment at the Royal Marsden in Fulham, would drive. They'd spend hours sitting in the cafe, getting to know the staff and the regulars. When it was time to leave, Jeff would drive Irene home. Many times I would even give them food on the house. I never saw them as customers, not really. I treated them as I would dear friends dropping by my home, welcomed with warmth, not transactions. We shared stories, laughs, worries, slices of life. That kind of familiarity breeds connection, and over time, a bond took root. Irene, Jeff, and a few others who had once stood proudly in the church pews on my wedding day now returned with puzzled eyes, disbelief etched in their faces. How could it end so soon? They asked, though mostly with silence. I didn't have the answer. I was asking myself the same thing. I'd always been a traditionalist. Marriage was sacred to me, a vow not to be broken. Divorce belonged in other people's stories, not mine. And yet, there I was, standing knee-deep in the crumbling aftermath of what I thought would be forever, powerless to undo it, powerless to change the script. That autumn, change came in another form, just next door. Pentland House, the old, sprawling property owned by Goldsmiths College, had been undergoing renovations. It always had a certain Gothic charm, weathered bricks, creaking floorboards, ivy creeping up the walls like time itself was trying to pull it back. The old college kitchens, hidden away at the far end, were transformed into a beautiful two-bedroom end-of-terrace house, full of quirks and corners and history. To my surprise and joy, my friends David and Penny Glencourse bought it and moved in with their son, Rory. Rory wasn't just any boy. He was one of Josh's best mates. And now, with only a garden fence between us, the two were inseparable. Every day, Rory's laughter drifted through our windows like birdsong. It brought a kind of brightness that softened the weight I was carrying. I built them a skateboard ramp at the far end of our garden, a sloping beast of wood and wheels. That ramp became their stage, their sanctuary. All three of my boys were drawn to anything that moved fast and rolled with freedom. Rollerblades, scooters, bikes. If it had wheels, they conquered it. But Josh had something else, an extra spark. He could do things you'd only expect from a circus act. He'd mastered the unicycle like he was born on it, balancing with a fluid grace that defied gravity. He juggled like a seasoned performer, tossed the Diablo high into the air, snatched it mid-spin with a snap of the string, and sent it soaring again, effortless. Spectacle was in his blood. He didn't just do tricks, he owned them. I remember watching him walk along the thin iron railing that bordered the children's playground, arms outstretched like a tightrope walker, never wavering. Kids watched in awe. Parents did double takes. So it wasn't all that surprising when one afternoon he discovered a dusty old unicycle in a friend's garden shed. Without hesitation, he climbed on and rode it as though it had always been his. No practice, no falls, just movement, balance, rhythm. His friend's mom watched from the kitchen window, mouth open in astonishment. "You can keep it," she said, as if gifting a sword to a knight who clearly already knew how to wield it. And just like that, Josh had another extension of himself, another way to defy the ordinary. In a time where so much felt uncertain and out of reach, that small stretch of garden, that ramp, those spinning wheels, they gave us something solid, something joyful, something still ours. It started with a simple idea, one of those flashes that hits you on a quiet walk through the park when the sunlight hits just right and your mind begins to dream. I pictured a bustling Sunday market, right there in the heart of the park. Stalls brimming with color and character, the air alive with music and the scent of freshly baked bread. A place that brought people together, gave the park a rhythm, a pulse. As I started digging into how to make it happen, I stumbled across a name that kept cropping up. Chris Elder, a quiet titan of the London market scene. He was the man behind the big monthly event at Alexandra Palace and a string of others scattered across the city. His company, City and Country Farmers Markets Limited, or CCFM, had become a bit of an institution. Chris wasn't just some clipboard-wielding organizer. He was a lifer, a food man through and through. The kind of bloke who didn't just talk about quality, he lived it. He came from a big, boisterous family of food lovers and had made his mark early, back in 1986, launching a small business making gourmet vegetarian-ready meals, back when that was still a novelty. He eventually sold it to the legendary Crank's restaurant chain, a nod to just how good his meals really were. By the late 90s, Chris had shifted into consultancy, guiding bakeries and chilled food companies with a laser focus on organic produce. He had an eye for where the market was going and a nose for what people wanted. In 2001, he founded City and Country, launching his very first farmers market at Dulwich College. It was a hit, more followed. A couple of years in, his daughter Sophie joined the ride. She brought a whole new energy, young, sharp, with a designer's flair and a head for logistics. She handled bookings, admin, the craft section, and built out the retail brand with finesse. Together, they were a force. By 2004, I knew they were the right people for the job. I reached out to Chris and introduced him to Carrie, who was then managing events for Glendale. Carrie got it straight away. She loved the idea, saw the vision, and gave the green light for a market to run on the first Sunday of every month. And when it finally launched, my God, it was something. The quality was off the charts. The stalls looked like they belonged in a magazine spread. Farmers with dirt still on their boots laid out crates of just-picked produce. There were organic butchers, artisan cheese sellers, golden jars of honey that shimmered in the sunlight. Moroccan food simmered in cast-iron pans. Freshly baked cakes lined up beside tubs of handmade skincare, each with its own story. You could sip on cold craft cider while watching Irish dancers stamp out ancient rhythms. Chris didn't just bring food, he brought life. Music drifted through the trees. Fiddles, country twangs, laughter. He booked everything from bluegrass bands to Irish folk trios. Yeehaw indeed. Josh, of course, became part of the show. He'd spin and leap with his Irish dancing, legs a blur, crowds clapping along. Then he'd switch gears. Out came the Diabolo, flying high into the air like a comet, spinning, twirling, and landing with pinpoint precision. People watched, wide-eyed. Phones came out. Applause followed. He was the heartbeat of the park some days. It was everything I'd imagined, and more. The energy, the community, the sheer joy of it. And yet, beneath the music and market magic, a quiet ache gnawed at me. Diantlin. I missed them in ways I struggled to admit, even to myself. Their absence clung to me like smoke after a fire, always there, even when the air seemed clear. Smiles came easy at the market, but the void was never far behind. The park was alive. I was proud. But inside, part of me was still wandering, still reaching back for something I had lost. Christmas crept up faster than I was ready for, wrapped not in tinsel and cheer, but in a quiet, aching sadness I hadn't anticipated. I had pictured it so differently, our first big family Christmas, full of warmth, chaos, and everyone together. But reality had other plans. Instead, it was just me and the boys. No tree filled with shared memories, no matching pajamas or sentimental surprises, just us, and the hollow space where something more was supposed to be. Still, I tried to rally. I invited Luke and Audrey to join us for Christmas lunch, hoping to fill the room with familiar voices, and Alkin, my brother, came too. He was going through his own heartbreak, newly separated, a mirror to my own silent unraveling. The boys lit up around him. He had that easy charm, that way of making everything feel like an adventure, even if you were just peeling potatoes. On Christmas morning, I stepped next door with a sack of gifts for David, Penny, and their son Rory, the usual ritual. But I was barely through the gate when David opened the door, eyes wide with panic, looking like a man facing imminent doom. "We've got a disaster," he gasped. He'd invited a tableful of guests from the media world, producers, execs, big wigs, for a proper Christmas spread. Impressive on paper. Except for one minor issue. Not a single kitchen appliance worked. Oven dead, hob lifeless. They'd lived in the house for 3 months without so much as boiling an egg, takeaways, restaurants, the odd packet of crisps. Now, when it really mattered, they were staring down the barrel of a raw turkey and cold sprouts. I couldn't help but laugh. Classic David. "What time are they due?" I asked, already scanning the mental inventory of my own kitchen. "Noon," he said, voice rising. "They think we're doing a full roast." "All right," I said, clapping him on the back. "Bring everything over to mine." I had a double oven, a 5-burner hob, and, most importantly, a calm head in a crisis. We grabbed trays, dishes, bags of groceries, and marched everything next door like a festive military operation. I rolled up my sleeves, turned on some music, and got to work. David, eternally grateful, kept ferrying over bottles of champagne, fuel, he called it, to keep me going. By bottle number 2, I was half cut and cheerfully basting someone else's turkey like I'd trained for it. Their guests arrived right on time, faces glowing, none the wiser to the culinary chaos that had unfolded just hours before. Crisis averted. Except, I still had our own Christmas dinner to cook. Somehow I rallied. Back in my own kitchen, I threw everything in the oven and hoped for the best. The champagne kept flowing, and inevitably, most of it ended up burned. Potatoes too crispy. Pigs in blankets more like pigs in cremation. But no one cared. We were together, laughing at the madness, scraping the charred bits off the roast, sipping warm wine from mismatched glasses. The food was secondary. The day was full of stories, of family, of salvaged moments that somehow meant more than perfection ever could. It wasn't the Christmas I had planned, but in its own chaotic, smoke-filled way, it was beautiful. Because in the end, we were still around the table. Still together. and in that, there was more joy than I'd expected. The next day, on Boxing Day, there was a knock at the door. To my surprise and quiet relief, Diane was standing there, looking upset and asking if we could talk. Naturally, I was pleased to see her, but cautious too. I invited her into the hallway, but quickly decided it would be better if we went out somewhere. A lot had happened, and I didn't want to unsettle my boys, especially after all the bad-mouthing that had gone on during her absence. I didn't want Diane to feel unnecessarily uncomfortable either. I asked if she minded going for a drive to talk, and she agreed. We headed up through Blackheath toward Greenwich Park. As we drove, Diane tearfully told me she still loved me, and that she regretted listening to her sisters and mother. They had convinced her I couldn't be trusted. Through tears, she revealed that she had suffered a miscarriage, something I hadn't even known about. I was shocked and deeply upset, though part of me wasn't sure whether to believe her. But in my heart, I wanted to, so I did. She asked me how I felt. I told her that I still loved her and was sorry for everything. I admitted that her past was her own, and I had no right to be upset about it. Yet I couldn't help but say that I wished she had been more open with me. I had always worn my heart on my sleeve while she kept her cards close to her chest. We were very different people, but it still felt like we belonged to each other. I also asked about Adrian and why his car was parked outside her house. Diane explained that he was estranged from his wife and had temporarily rented a room at her mother's place. Since she only had one parking spot behind her house, and the council charged for additional parking, Adrian had asked to park for free outside her property on Manor Lane while he laid her new oak flooring. Hearing that, I felt foolish and apologized again. I admitted I couldn't believe she had called the police on me, just as she confessed she couldn't believe I had smashed her door open. In the car that day, we agreed to reconcile, but slowly and with more open communication. It wasn't just about us anymore. We had our children to consider. We decided that it would be best to sell both of our houses and start fresh together in a new home. It felt right, starting anew together, as one family. I knew my boys would always see 28 Old Road as their true home, no matter what changes or improvements were made to make space for everyone. Diane would revert to staying at her house in the meantime, visiting on weekends as she had before. She gently broke the news to her children. Caitlin, however, didn't take it well and chose to move in with her grandmother Opal. Diane also made a strong decision. She no longer wanted contact with her sisters. She said they had been the real catalyst behind her rash decision to leave, and if our reconciliation was to work, cutting ties with them was necessary for her. I couldn't fully understand how she could walk away from her family like that. It's not something I could ever imagine doing with mine. At first, even my friends weren't supportive of our getting back together. Leaving Old Road was harder than anything I had ever expected. It crushed Remy. And moving day. 28th July 2005, his birthday, felt like a cruel final blow. The new house felt wrong from the beginning. Empty, too big, too quiet. Diane and her children didn't move in properly. Caitlin stayed with her grandmother. Diane's house, the one she had promised to sell so we could build a new life together, remained stubbornly unsold, untouched. Bit by bit, I saw it for what it was. I had uprooted everything, my home, my boys, my history, and there I stood, alone, holding the pieces. Selling Old Road hadn't just been a choice. It had become a necessity. Over the years, I had borrowed heavily against the house through drawdowns, funding the deposit towards the pizza restaurant in Lee Gate, our first buy-to-let property, others that followed, and even helping pay for our wedding plans. The financial weight had become too much. Selling Old Road was the only way to clear the slate and give us a fresh start. And so I did what needed to be done. I kept my promise. Even as I stood in an unfamiliar kitchen, feeling the silence pressing in around me, I clung to the belief that Diane would soon do the same. But instead, she seemed to drift further away. We had started making new plans for our future and began searching for a new home together. It felt hopeful, like we were finally moving towards something solid again. During one of our conversations, I brought up the drawdown on Diane's flat, reminding her that the original plan had been to reinvest the money into another property. She hesitated, then explained that there wasn't much left. Most of it had gone toward the children's school fees and finishing off some minor renovations before she put the house on the market. It wasn't what we had agreed, but I tried to swallow my disappointment. When I shared the news of our reconciliation with my sons and close friends, their reactions hit me harder than I expected. Mixed at best, mostly negative. David didn't hold back. He said straight out that I was mad, that Diane couldn't be trusted. Marco agreed with him, without hesitation. Even Fred and Martin, who were usually the voices of reason, shared their doubts, though they were gentler about it. Fred, ever the practical one, pointed out that maybe starting fresh somewhere new wasn't such a bad idea. After all, Sally's memory was everywhere at Old Road, and Diane would always be living in that shadow. At home, the mood was heavy. Remy was heartbroken about leaving, and Ben grew distant, withdrawing more and more into himself. I didn't realize then that he had already started spending nights at an older friend's flat, experimenting with drugs. Josh, still young, seemed untouched by the undercurrents pulling the rest of us apart. Diane and I agreed to put any bigger property ambitions on hold until we were actually living together. I put 28 Old Road up for sale, a house that had been more than just bricks and mortar. It had been a witness to so many moments of our lives. Before long, I found a large 5-bedroom, 3-reception semi-detached house on Chimbrook Road. It had a huge, sun-drenched south-facing garden and a driveway that could fit 5 cars, plenty of room for all of us, or so I had hoped. We agreed a price of £346,000. My house sold for £427,000, and after clearing my outstanding mortgage of £320,000, I had enough left to make it happen. I paid off the mortgage business and arranged a new repayment mortgage through Halifax, once again in my own name. Diane hadn't sold yet, and with no income to declare, she couldn't be added. But we had agreed. Once her house was sold, her name would go on the mortgage too. I clung to that promise. Moving day arrived, the removal men boxed everything up, and the house that had once been so full of life now echoed with emptiness. We sat in the bare living room, waiting for the final call from the solicitors. Then came the crash. I rushed outside to find bricks and mortar strewn across the patio, and there, on the flat roof of the kitchen, stood Josh, cheeks flushed with guilt. "What the hell are you doing up there?" I snapped. He shrugged, helpless, as if he genuinely didn't know. My heart was pounding. New owners would be arriving soon, and now this. I rang Fred, my old faithful. He turned up within the hour, a bag of cement in one hand and tools in the other, and patched it up as if it had never happened. I don't think I could have gotten through those days without friends like him. Leaving Old Road broke something inside me. It wasn't just a house. It was where Sally's memory still lived, where the boys had grown up, where laughter had once filled the hallways. And now, as we moved, on Remy's birthday of all days, the weight of everything we were leaving behind felt almost unbearable. Moving into Chinbrook Road should have felt like a fresh start. Instead, it felt hollow. Diane and her children didn't move in properly. Caitlin stayed with her grandmother. Diane's house remained unsold. Day by day, it became clearer. I'd been stitched up. I had sold my home, taken on a new mortgage, uprooted my sons, and Diane, the woman I had trusted to build this new life with, was still sitting on the fence. As if life wasn't complicated enough, just before the move, the police showed up at my door. They informed me that my tenants had been arrested for growing cannabis in the loft, and worse still, operating a brothel from the flat. I was stunned, speechless. I had no idea. They had always paid their rent in cash, and I had carefully kept a paper trail, depositing it straight into my account and using it to cover the mortgage. Looking back, no wonder they hadn't cared about the gaping crack in the chimney breast. They were running a criminal empire under my nose. With the flats now practically worthless, there was no way we could rent them out again. Not until Little's insurance payout came through for the damages they had caused. They had accepted liability, but it was now just a waiting game. More uncertainty. More pressure. The tension between Diane and me only grew. I tried to remind her, "We agreed on this. We planned this together." I had kept my word. Selling my house, moving the boys, taking a risk, but she was nowhere near meeting me halfway. To make matters worse, she had taken in 2 young French girls she met in our cafe, offering them rooms at a peppercorn rent after they fled a bad landlord situation on Burnt Ash Road. I admired her heart, but it wasn't the plan. Meanwhile, I had my own unplanned house guest, a former Shaolin monk I had taken on to work at the cafe. When he ran into trouble with his accommodation, I let him sleep in the games room in the cellar, temporarily, not wanting to disturb the boys' routines any further. Thankfully, he moved on just before we left Old Road. I didn't want to pressure Diane unnecessarily, but deep down, I knew this wasn't the life we had agreed to build together. Moving the boys had been emotional enough without the added loneliness and uncertainty. Grove Park was only 2 miles from the cafe, but every drive felt longer than it should have, a constant reminder that life, once so close and simple, had suddenly stretched out into something unfamiliar and painfully complicated. I had dreamed of a new beginning. Instead, I found myself longing for the old life I had so willingly left behind. But then, something shifted. I don't know what changed. Was it that Caitlin had finally come back home to her mother? Or was it Diane's conscience, knowing that I had stayed true to my word and carried out the plan we had both agreed upon? I wasn't going to question it. I was simply ecstatic. Slowly, Diane and her children moved in. We rearranged the house to fit this new version of our family. Caitlin was given the bright front bedroom over the hall. Diane and I took the room next door, side by side with her. Theo and Josh shared the large double room overlooking the garden. Ben took the smaller bedroom to the left of the bathroom. The tiny box room became our study. Raimi, ever the independent spirit, set up his new bedroom in what had once been the downstairs study. It wasn't perfect, but it was ours. It felt like maybe, finally, we were beginning to stitch a new life together from the wreckage of the old one. In April 2006, Diane finally sold her house for £350,000, nearly a year after I had made my leap of faith. It was a bittersweet moment, proof that some promises are kept, just not always when you need them most. The day I didn't believe my sons,